Good morning, everybody. Hopefully I'll be around long enough so that we can have a regular meeting at some point in time. I know everybody's tired of doing it the way we're having to do it, but that's just the way it is. Before we begin, I need to take a roll call. I know our chairman, Reed, is out. He got his COVID shots and is not, he's fine, but he's not feeling well, and so that's why he's not here today. Vice Chair Beaver, are you there?
Yeah, Dick, I'm here. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Abel, are you there?
I am. I'm here.
Okay. I know Commissioner Bell is not. Commissioner Galo is going to be here, but I don't think she's here yet. Are you, Anna? Don't think so. I know Commissioner Hildebrand is here. I'm sitting next to him. And I know Commissioner Latimer is here. Bobby, are you here yet?
He is on listen only mode, Mr. Chairman, and so he's listening.
Okay, Bobby. Well, hopefully we'll hear from you soon, and then I guess I can say that I'm here. Let's call the meeting to order at 9. What was that? I heard somebody talking. I thought somebody had looked. Let's call the meeting to order at 9:47 a.m. Before we proceed, I believe Carter has a statement to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, a public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agendas has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. Mr. Chairman, I'd like for this official fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you.
All my fellow commissioners, as a reminder, before you speak, please announce your name. And speak slowly so that the court reporter can get all your comments recorded. Let's see. And Carter, we talked about this. I don't think we have a quorum, so we need to come back to the approval of the minutes, correct?
Well, actually, I think we can go through them. I've got Commissioner Patton's proxy, and so I'll share his vote when you come to tonight.
Okay.
So I think we can go through it. Yeah, thanks.
Okay. So, if that being the case, I need a motion to approve the minutes from the previous work session of November 9th. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
A second.
Commissioner Laffer.
All in favor, please say aye.
Applin, aye.
Chairman, unfortunately, just going to have to go through the bureaucracy of going through the names.
We're going to have to. Yeah. I know we're going to have to go through it. Yeah. Well, I know. Reed isn't. Chairman Morian's not here. Applin, we've got your vote. Thank you.
Abel,
Commissioner
yes.
Abel.
Abel, yes.
Commissioner Bell's not here. Commissioner Galo is not on yet. I don't think.
I approve. I'm on. Hi.
Oh, you're on. Oh, yeah. Good morning. How are you doing, Anna?
Good. How are you?
Other than a little cedar fever, I can't complain.
Good.
Okay. Commissioner Hildebrand?
Aye.
Commissioner Latimer?
Aye.
Carter, you got Commissioner Patton's proxy?
Yeah, Commissioner Patton let us know that he approves the minutes.
Okay, and I vote aye. Any opposed? Not hearing any opposition, then the motion is approved. Okay. Next order of business is the approval of the minutes from the annual public hearing held November the 9th, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
Commissioner Lott.
Dato.
Second.
Second.
Voting will be by the roll call again. I know Chairman Morin's not here. Vice
yes.
Chair Applin. Okay.
Yes.
Commissioner Abel.
Yes.
Commissioner Bell. Oh, Gala, yes. Okay, on. Thank you. Hildebrand.
Yes.
Latimer, yes. And Carter has Bobby's or Commissioner Patton's proxy, and I vote yes.
Yeah.
any opposition? Hearing none, the motion carries. Okay, now we'll move on to work session item number one. Update on the Parks and Wildlife Department's progress in implementing the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Carter, please make your presentation.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Carter Smith with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. I've had the chance to share a few words on this update this morning related to items germane to the Land and Water Plan. I wonder if I could get the next slide. Just as a point of departure on internal affairs, Mike and Johnny and Mark and Patty and the team continue to do an excellent job in that function, critically important function for the agency. Do want to let the commissioners know that I believe as of today, the internal affairs director position will be formally posted. That will be open to qualified internal applicants, either state park police officers or game wardens who meet the requisite qualifications and experience and tenure and so forth. And so we'll have that application open for a couple of weeks to interested and qualified candidates, and then we'll review those, interview them, and then make a selection in February is my time frame on that. So we'll let you know as that progresses. But obviously that's the successor to Jonathan Gray. And in the interim, Mike Durand's been doing a terrific job in an acting capacity, is supported by his team. So Andrew, next slide. I'm very pleased to announce our new chief financial officer, who's here with us today, Reggie Pegues. Reggie, raise your hand here so at least the commissioners here can see it. Reggie brings a terrific background to this job, and he's no stranger to the Parks and Wildlife Department. He was here in 2008 when I first came back to the department, and then he was lured away to Family and Protective Services by our CFO at the time. But Reggie was our chief budget officer for, I guess, 5 years, and so he knows our finances inside and out, the Fund 64, the Fund 9, the sporting goods sales tax, all the dedicated funding streams that we have and the complexity of our different revenue and budgeting streams. He's got great relationships with the team already, be it Justin or Lance or Julie, and has got a lot of experience that he brings to us from DPS and DIR and other agency. But he's a great asset. He's a CPA, proud graduate of UT Tyler, and has already made a huge contribution with getting us prepared for the session budgetarily and financially, and work through issues with the governor's office on COVID-related funding reimbursements and so forth. And so, Reggie, welcome to the team. Formally thrilled to have you. I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge Justin Halverson here in the room with us. Justin, no stranger to the commission, has done an extraordinary job in an acting capacity, and I want to thank him for his service and leadership, of which he will continue to provide as a member of our financial resources leadership team. And so, Justin, thanks for helping to carry the ball while we were able to go through the process of filling this position. And so thank you, and again, welcome, Reggie. Andrew, let's go to the next slide. Each year, our friends at the Shikara Safari Club, which, as you all know, is that organization comprised of international sportsmen and conservationists, select the Wildlife Officer of the Year. And this year's Officer of the Year is Justin Solis from down in Rockport, Aransas County. Justin's been with us as a game warden for 7 or 8 years. When he got out of the academy, Commissioner Galo, he spent 3 years down in Webb County, and then transferred back to Rockport, where he has – deeply embedded himself in the community and is making a difference in all kinds of ways. As an aside, his dad works for us in infrastructure. It's so nice to have a father-son team working for the department, albeit in different functions and divisions. But Justin has really shown himself in the community. He's set up a kids program encouraging kids to, you know, go for fish, not drugs, and try to deal with rural drug issues, and been a great role model. Worked very effectively with one of our conservation partners in Aransas Bay, Flatsworthy, to help work on issues related to all of the boater and user conflict that we see out in the bays, and work with them to design a new patrol boat that our game wardens could use in the area, and that Flatsworthy raised upwards of $80,000 to buy and purchase and then donate to our law enforcement team down there. He's also a member of our Region 8, our kind of South Texas coast fishing team that works on everything from interdiction of illegal Mexican vessels coming into U.S. and Texas waters to helping to lead operations to address all of the commercial and recreational fishing related pressures that we see in that area. So Justin has really distinguished himself and a very deserving honoree and awardee of the Shikar Safari Club Officer of the Year. And I'm sorry he's not with us today to be recognized in person, but we'll extend the commission's gratitude to him. Andrew, next slide. Similarly, the Midwestern Association of Fish and Game Officers will select an Officer of the Year from all the member states, and no surprise that John Koshin out of Victoria County was this year's Midwest Officer of the Year. John's been with us for almost 18 years. He spent the entirety of his career down in Victoria County, where he's developed terrific relationships with the ranching community and also the local law enforcement community and just the citizenry at large. Any number of hallmarks from his service and leadership there, from, you know, apprehending armed bike robbers that he was able to locate, to saving some kayakers who'd been washed away in floods in the Guadalupe River. He organized and led a major aquatic patrol effort called Tres Bahias in a five-county area to organize our game wardens on a special operation in the bays to work on water safety and fishing-related violations. And most recently, John has been very involved in helping to develop and launch our FDO program, or our field training officer program, for our state park police officers and our game wardens. And so proud of John's leadership, and he's doing a terrific job down there, very well respected, and proud of him for this recognition as the Midwest Officer of the Year. So again, Chairman, we'll pass on the congratulations and the thanks from the commission. Andrew, next slide. Tomorrow, y'all are going to have a chance to hear a detailed presentation from Craig Bonds on the development of our statewide R3 plan. And this is our part of a much bigger nationwide effort aimed at recruiting, retaining, and reactivating hunters, anglers, boaters, and shooting sports enthusiasts. This is a national priority, not just for fish and wildlife agencies, but for conservation organizations, but also the recreational sporting industries, from firearms manufacturers to boat manufacturers and dealers and others that are in this space. And as we confront the challenges of changed and evolving demographics, as well as the competition for leisure time and the lack of mentors in the outdoor space, we're all having to redouble our efforts to make sure that we can continue to expand and grow and diversify our hunters and anglers and shooting and boating enthusiasts. One very relatively simple and low-cost way that we can help achieve those goals has been worked on by our communications and specifically our marketing team, Darcy Bontempo and Carly Montez and others. to target new anglers that are buying fishing licenses for the first time, with sending them a series of introductory emails, introducing them to the sport of fishing, giving them links to new resources, and helping do everything we can to make their new fishing experiences successful and easy and seamless. And that's been very well received. Also, in working on these issues associated with churn, which is a term that's used for purchasers of hunting and angling licenses who don't renew their licenses on a every year basis, they have been sending reminder emails to purchasers of the year-to-date all water fishing licenses to encourage them to purchase their license again, and that's been very successful. Also, one of the priorities of the commission has been for the agency to acquire more email addresses of licensed hunters and anglers so we can reach them again with specific information and again work on all of these retention and reactivation related efforts. Historically, we would secure email addresses when hunters and anglers would buy their licenses online. Now, when somebody buys a license in an over-the-counter related environment, be that Walmart or Academy or a local sporting goods store, they are asked to provide their email address when they're buying their license. Now, that's not a condition of getting the license. If they either don't have an email or they choose not to give it, that's fine. They can still get their license. But we've significantly increased the acquisition of emails and being able to target and reach our hunting and angling constituents. And in a pilot project last year, Darcy and the team sent out reminder emails to over 230,000 hunters and anglers about renewing their licenses, and you can see a little table there on the slide that shows the results of their targeted efforts versus a control group that did not get any reminder emails. And the lift was, you know, anywhere from 2.4 to upwards of 6%, depending on the license type. And ultimately, they generated over almost $400,000 more from renewals from the test group as opposed to the control group. And so as the number of emails expand and we can reach more individuals, this again is going to be a very low cost way in which we can work on retention and reactivation in a very smart, thoughtful, and strategic way. So very proud of our communications team, Michelle and Darcy and Carly and that whole bunch. Audra, next slide. We're in the 22nd year, Clayton, I guess, of the Big Time Texas Hunt program, in which hunters can buy a chance at exclusive guided hunts around the state. And these are, you know, special hunts. Maybe it's for, you know, trophy whitetail deer or mule deer or pronghorn or a nilgai or an alligator. And for $10 a chance, you know, a hunter can buy as many as they want for any of these types of hunts around the state, some of which are on wildlife management areas, but most of which are on private lands that we contract with, as well as guides to run the hunts. The funds that are generated support wildlife conservation and habitat for our wildlife division, so it's a great generator of funds for conservation and stewardship. 2020, perhaps no surprise, we had the largest number of entries ever, over 135,000 entries. And as you can see, we had the greatest gross sales in the 22-plus year history, a 30-plus percent increase and generated a little over $1.2 million in sales. So we were proud of that. We were also able to offer up kind of the first of its kind, a blast and cast, a package down there at the Powderhorn Ranch there at Port O'Connor. And so the winning hunter gets to come down. They can hunt waterfowl, get a chance at a trophy sambar deer, or axis, whitetail deer. They can duck hunt, and then they can also wade for redfish and trout on that 10 miles of shoreline there on the Powderhorn Ranch shoreline. So that proved to be a very, very popular one. But again, just another terrific partnership between our communications and marketing teams and wildlife divisions, and proud of the efforts they're providing to offer more hunting opportunities, but also to generate revenue for conservation and stewardship. Next slide, Andrew. I want to provide a quick overview of essentially the last year of the partnership that we've had with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to implement the Gulf Environmental Benefit Fund. And as some of the commissioners that have been here for a while will recall, one of the silver linings out of that terrible Deepwater Horizon tragedy was the resources that were made available to invest in restoring and enhancing and protecting resources that were impacted from that deepwater oil spill in the Gulf. And as you will recall, there were a variety of different funding streams set up that the responsible parties had to pay into. One were the civil-related funds that were paid into the Natural Resource Damage Assessment Program, which Parks and Wildlife, along with the General Land Office and TCEQ, administer the Restore Act funding, which set up a whole new federal agency to oversee, to invest in a wide series of conservation, restoration, and research projects. And then there were the criminal penalties that were assessed against the responsible party of roughly $2.4 billion. In the settlement decree with the Department of Justice, those funds were given to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to act as the fiduciary for those funds. Every dollar had to be spent on conserving or restoring or enhancing resources specifically impacted by the spill. So, meaning that funds would have to be invested in to protect things like migratory birds or seagrass or oysters or shoreline habitats, again, that were impacted. That portion of the award that was allocated for Texas was $203 million. We were, you know, clearly impacted by the spill, but the least impacted of all the Gulf states. And the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is opposed to setting up a big bureaucracy to oversee that grant program. It did something that I think was very prescient and strategic, and that was to partner with their state agency partners to decide how best to allocate and distribute those funds to meet the terms of the criminal settlement decree with the Department of Justice. And so in Texas, that agency was really Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, with support from our partners at GLO and TCEQ. And so what NFWF, National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, asked of Parks and Wildlife during this 7 or 8 year partnership was to identify the priority geographies for investments, to identify target resources that needed to be invested in, whether it be species or habitat types, and then essentially to oversee the grant application process for getting nonprofit and other public conservation agencies to apply for those grants. Our team scored and vetted those projects, and then ultimately we made recommendations to the NFWF board for funding. And I want to specifically acknowledge the leadership of Robin Rikers and Ted Hollingsworth, who've just done a masterful job leading this effort for the state of Texas over the last 7 or 8 years. This has been the most efficient and, I think, effective program coming out of the Deepwater Horizon effort in terms of quickly getting dollars on the ground to benefit the natural resources that we're charged to protect. And that's a no small part due to Robin and Ted's leadership. Really, really proud of them. This is the last year of funding for the program. We had roughly $19 million to invest along the coast. And so as you can see here, we invested in things like purchasing a conservation easement on, you know, roughly 11,000 acres of the remaining Powderhorn Ranch to the west of the big property that we acquired, working on shoreline protection and restoration projects there in Matagorda Bay, or doing more hydrologic restoration down at the Bahia Grande. So some excellent projects to finish off this effort. But let me give you just a very quick snapshot of what was accomplished in this 7 or 8 year partnership. Andrew, if you'll go to the next slide. You can see this slide. It depicts all of the projects that were invested in up and down the Texas coast, from Sabine Lake all the way down to Boca Chica. You can see the yellow or orange dots represent land conservation projects where we invested in acquiring land to add to state parks or wildlife management areas or national wildlife refuges. See habitat restoration in purple. That kind of pinkish color is for avian habitat restoration, like Rookery Island related things, but also you see beach and habitat restoration projects. There were 60 projects that were funded with this partnership. That $203 million was essentially doubled in its impact with matching funds from the other entities besides Parks and Wildlife that were recipient of funds. Were over, I think, 35 or so, and that ranged from entities like, Ducks Unlimited, Nature Conservancy, Texas Agricultural Land Trust, Fish and Wildlife Service, Galveston Bay Foundation, Coastal Bend Bays and Estuaries Program, Conservation Fund, and a host of other nonprofits that just really did some terrific work around the entire Texas coast. Next slide, Andrew. This is a shot just of the Upper Coast related projects, and you'll see Sabine Lake and Salt Bayou and Galveston Bay. Chairman Scott, you'll of course remember the big project that we worked on there in Jefferson Bayou to help restore Salt Bayou and help bring fresh water back into the marsh and restore that massive marsh complex influencing, over 18,000 acres of wetlands. The roughly 20 miles of shoreline that were restored upward up there at Bolivar Peninsula, the Keith Lake Fish Pass, the acquisition of the big ranch to add to the Anahuac National Wildlife Refuge. Chairman, that again, that local area and specifically Judge Brannick was so very supportive of out in Galveston Bay. We're able to invest in over 100 acres of oyster reefs, added a major land acquisition there at Chocolate Bayou through the Galveston Bay Foundation, lots of shoreline protection, some great bird rookery-related projects. Next slide, Andrew. Going down to the mid-coast, we were able to do projects, of course, like the big Powderhorn Ranch project there on Matagorda Bay, and other projects there on the Matagorda Peninsula, a lot of Rookery Island projects in San Antonio Bay and Matagorda Bay to help protect our threatened water birds who've had a lot of pressures in recent years, and some really good private lands-related work by our partners at Ducks Unlimited and the Texas Ag Land Trust and the Nature Conservancy. Let's go to the next slide down south. And then down on the very lower coast, our projects were largely focused on restoring that massive Bahia Grande complex there between Brownsville and Port Isabel, which is essentially a 12 to 15,000 acre former tidally influenced wetland, but with the construction of the Brownsville Ship Channel, those tidal waters were no longer providing wetland habitats, and that essentially wetland habitat had dried up into a big dust bowl. And so with the NIFWIF funding, we were able to help restore that hydrologic regime down there, acquired a number of key tracts at South Padre to add to the Laguna Atascosa National Wildlife Refuge, and also to provide critical protection of wetland and brush tracks to connect the Laguna Atascosa with the Lower Rio Grande Valley National Wildlife Refuges. So all in all, commissioners, I'm very, very proud of the conservation work that came out of this tragedy, and I'm very grateful to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation for their trust in Parks and Wildlife and the state of Texas as whole to help lead these conservation efforts. And again, Robin and Ted and many others on the team, along with our partners at TCEQ and GLO, just did a terrific job of implementing this. So good stuff there. Next slide, Andrew. Last slide, and I put this in primarily really because Chairman Morian was interested in this, but this is the second year of the experimental four doe day season in the post-oak belt, essentially extending from out of Fayette and Lee County down to Cuero there in DeWitt County, so roughly 21 counties in which an experimental four-day doe season was put in place around Thanksgiving in those counties to help with the management of antlerless deer numbers. One of the conditions of that was that anybody that harvested antlerless deer had to report that harvest through the My Texas Hunt Harvest app. And we provided an update to the commission last year on that. I think we had a very successful rollout, and I'm proud of our wildlife and IT teams and LA teams for getting all that up and running and kind of hear the results from the second year. And by and large, they really mirrored what happened in year number one. Next slide, Kendra. This table just shows kind of where the largest numbers of does were harvested. As you can see, almost 75% of them were killed during those four doe days during the general season around Thanksgiving, and then 21% were killed during the archery season. Hunters also had an opportunity to harvest them during the special use season at the end of October, and then also during the muzzleloader season. But the largest numbers were harvested during that four doe day season. Next slide. Out of the, you know, roughly 3,659 or so antlerless deer that were harvested, you can see here by county the reporting, you know, largest numbers, and perhaps not surprisingly, you know, down in DeWitt County around Cuero, large numbers of deer there. Colorado, Bastrop County having good numbers. You know, Kamal County, only that portion east of I-35 was included in this area, so that doesn't include harvested does in that hill country part of Kamal County, which I think explains why that number is so low. Last year, I think they were one or two deer killed east of 35 there. Next slide. Shows the counties here. You can see, you know, not surprisingly, you know, places like Lavaca or Lee County, Gonzales County, decent numbers of does harvested. Next slide. And then last but not least, you know, Wilson County around Stockdale, Nixon, that area, decent numbers of does that were harvested. Next slide. Total numbers of does harvested compared to last year, interestingly, was down about 9%. So perhaps that was a bit of a surprise. About what our biologists expected, roughly 80% of those that hunted antlerless deer in these counties harvested one deer, but you know, we had roughly 20% of the hunters take two. Next slide. And then in terms of reporting, and I think this is important as we continue to think about how we very strategically and robustly use digital devices to help with communication with our constituencies. You know, roughly 80% of the hunters reported their harvests on their mobile devices. And so with the Apple being one of the most preferred, but Android also being a popular device, and then roughly 20% of the reporting came in through the web. Chairman and commissioners, in terms of, you know, problems with the reporting was minimal at best. I think our game wardens and wildlife biologists reported 9 individuals in all of this that had some issue. They had, you know, it timed out on them, or they weren't able to find the deer management unit to report it in, or inadvertently put in the wrong county. I mean, really kind of minor related issues. So I think we could call this program a success by any means or measure with the first 2 years of the rollout, and again the use of the digital reporting through the app. So real pleased with that, Chairman, and how that's turned out for the second year of this program. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation. And if anybody has any questions for me on any of those topics, I'm happy to address them.
Are there any questions about our mission? Having heard none, thank you, Carter.
Thank you.
Chairman, Commissioner Scott, you're muted.
What have I did? I'll see you.
Like I said, I'm low tech. Okay, work session item number 2. Financial overview. Is Justin doing it, or who's going to do it?
Yeah, maybe you could get Justin.
Yep. And welcome back, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, I'm Justin Halverson, the Director of Revenue, here to present the financial overview. Next slide, please. There are three topics that I'm going to be covering today. The first is the FY20 year-end revenue summary. So that's going to be the revenue ending on August 31st. The second topic will be the FY21 revenue summaries, which will cover revenue from 9/1 through December 31. And the final topic will be the FY21 budget adjustments, also through December. Next slide, please. Okay, to kick it off, the year-end summaries, again, this is for fiscal year 2020, which is going to be ending on August 31st. And I'm going to be covering the three largest revenue sources that we have, which in order is license revenue, state park revenue, and boat revenue. Now, the slides that I'm going to be presenting represent revenue that goes into the Treasury. And so as such, this is going to be on a cash basis. It's not an accrual. This is on a cash basis. Next slide, please. Okay, this is license revenue 2020. You can see the total revenue was $114 million. And by month, as far as the trend, it goes exactly like what we expect it to. So 40% of the total revenue we acquired through the end of September. And then by the end of December, then we had gotten 65% of the revenue. So in terms of the overall flow by month, it ran exactly like what we expected. We did have a larger than expected bump in the spring associated with fishing. Next slide, please. So this is a comparison of license revenue across the previous 5 years. You can see, again, fiscal year 2020 at $114 million. It was just under 10% higher than what we had in fiscal year 2019 at $104 million. Again, that was 9.5% higher than it was in fiscal year 2019. Next slide, please. So this next slide compares fiscal year 19 and 20 by license type. That bump that I had talked about just a few minutes ago, you can really see that presented in the resident fishing license, which was 28.4% higher. The non-resident fish was effectively flat, negative by just a little bit at 0.5%. The non-resident hunting was down 5.8%. Most of that was attributed to the spring because of the lockdowns with COVID. That did have a negative impact on spring turkey. But again, overall total revenue was up 9.5%. Next slide, please. Okay, shifting to state parks. Again, by month, the total revenue was $47.1 million. And again, on this slide, this really presents well. You can see the impact of COVID-19. You can see the decline in revenue in March and in May, although we did have a nice recovery in the spring and summer. Again, $47.1 million closed out the revenue for state parks. Next slide, please. Okay, this compares the state park revenue over the last 5 years. We were down 13% in fiscal year 2020 compared to fiscal year 2019. But again, considering how bad things were looking in March and April, the recovery was actually quite strong. Next slide, please. Okay, so this slide, again, we're looking at state park revenue comparing 19 to 20 kind of by category. I'm going to point out the day use entrance and park pass was impacted the least. You can see that was negative 8% and 7.5% respectively. Facilities and activities, concessions, activities would be things like horseback riding or something like that. Those were impacted more substantially, negative 17% for facilities and activities and concession, down 37.4%. But again, overall, comparing 19 and 20, we were down 13.2%. Next slide, please. Okay, looking at boat revenue, the total boat revenue, again, this is for fiscal year 2020, ended at $22.9 million. As far as comparing it by month, again, you can see the impact of COVID in the early spring months in April. But much like state parks, you can see a fairly nice recovery as we headed into the summer months. Next slide, please. Okay, comparing boat revenue across the previous 5 years, you can see it's very consistent. 2020 ended slightly up 1.5%, but again, quite consistent for the last 5 years. Next slide, please. Okay, a little bit more detail on boat revenue comparing fiscal year 20 with 19. The titling you can see is negative, which indicates that there are fewer boats being purchased and transferred in 2020 compared to 2019. However, you'll notice that the sales tax retained was higher at 5.2%. So that's indicating that there were fewer transactions, but the transactions that did take place were a higher value. Next slide, please. Okay, so that closed out the summary of fiscal year 2020, which ended on August 31st. And I'm going to be the next slides, the next series of slides are going to be revenue starting on 9/1 through December 31st. Again, this is in order, license revenue, state park revenue, boat revenue. Next slide, please. Okay, license revenue, again, from 9/1 through December 31st, closed at $79.2 million. As far as the trend is trending exactly like what we would expect it to. Next slide, please. Okay, this next slide is comparing license revenue through December 31st through the previous 5 years, and we're up approximately 10% over where we were in license year 20. So again, it started out quite strong. Next slide, please. Okay, so this slide again is additional detail on license revenue. Now we're comparing fiscal year 2021 to 2020, and that strong increase that we had in resident fishing is also carrying forward. Now we're up 30%. Non-resident fishing, which was flat in fiscal year 2020, is now up 9.6%. And the non-resident hunting, which was down close to 6% in 2020, has recovered, and now it's down at approximately 1.7%. But again, overall license revenue is quite strong at 9.9% up 2021 comparing back to 2020. Next slide, please. Okay, state park revenue, again, this is from September 1st through December 31st, ended at $19.2 million. If you look at it by month, you'll see that there's not a lot of variation, really quite consistent and quite strong. Next slide, please. Okay, so now we're comparing state park revenue back for the previous 5 years. Very, very, very strong for fiscal year 2021, comparing it back to 2020. We're almost 25% higher than where we were at this point last year. Next slide. Okay, so this next slide provides that approximately 25% increase in a little bit more detail. And again, I'll point out the entrance and park passes are up approximately 30%. The facilities, which were down in fiscal year 2020, have recovered, and now they're up approximately 20%. And even activities and concessions, which closed out 2020 down by about 30%, is now down just 3.2%. Next slide. Okay, now we're looking at boat revenue. Closing out through December 31st was $6.1 million, and as far as the trend by month, it's flowing exactly like what we would expect it to. Next slide, please. Okay, comparing it at this point to the previous 5 years, boat revenue is also very strong. It's up almost 44% year over year. Next slide, please. Okay, this provides a little bit more detail on the boat revenue. I'll go ahead and again start out with titles, which were negative at the end of fiscal year 2020. Now through December 31st of 2021, it's up 52.4%, and sales tax is up 95.6%. So comparing at this point this year to where we were at last year, there are more boats being purchased, and the sales price of those is also higher. Next slide, please. Okay, so that wrapped up my revenue summaries. And now I'll be talking about the fiscal year 2021 budget adjustments. Next slide, please. Okay, this first slide was taken right off of the August commission meeting that I did. So we started out the year, the commission approved budget was at $444.6 million. Next slide, please. Okay, since that time, we've done approximately $191.2 million of adjustments, so I'm just going to go through a few of these and give you some highlights. The operational non-capital UB, UB is just a budgetary term for moving funds forward from one year into the next. We have the authority within the biennia to move operating and non-capital funds from the first year of the biennia to the second, which so far we have done to the tune of about $5.8 million. That ranges anything from some operating for the legal division for $1,000 all the way up to $1 million for a local park grant. The federal and UB at $63.3 million, that's approximately 30 grants, two-thirds of which is in the wildlife and sport fish restoration. The appropriated receipts in UB at $28.5 million. Approximately $16 million of that represents donations that were moved forward from 2020 to 2021, with an additional $1 million of donations that have been received in 21, so from 9/1 through December 31st. The capital construction UB of $84.7 million, that's approximately 140 construction projects, of one of which is about $12 million for the Palo Pinto construction development. Employee fringe of about $8.9 million, and then we get to our subtotal adjustments of $191.2. So we closed out December 31st with an adjusted budget of $635.8 million. Next slide, please. And that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Sure. Commissioner Hildebrand, question for you. Go back to that last line. Increase of $191 million on your budget. That's almost a 40% increase. I assume all of these line items are, reasonable, viable, but why the big – how do we – just adjust our budget by 40%. The budget was set on August 2020. How can it change this much? Another 9 million employment, fringe, unemployment, etc.
Sure. There's a couple things that I'll say on that. First of all, keep in mind that with state government, again, we have the ability to move funds forward from one year into the next. So a big portion of this is a function of the way that state government works and a rider that we have that allows us to carry funds available from one year into the next. So that's a big portion of why you're seeing when we started the budget at $444 million, that was only the beginning original budget that we had in the General Appropriations Act for fiscal year 21. That didn't include any of the money that we have the ability to move forward. Because our agency does a lot in construction, that's a big amount that gets moved forward, as well as federal funds. So the combination of those just means that there's a lot of money that is sitting in the previous year that we have the authority to move forward. Now, with respect to your question on fringe, that's a really good question, and there's a couple points that I'll make. Number one, on fringe, when we start out, the estimate for fringe in the General Appropriations Act is actually estimated by the LBB, and that's done a couple years ago. So their estimate is always very conservative. We have a better estimate as time goes on. Also, with that fringe number, I don't have the ability to budgetarily move any of that fringe budget to any other category. So we have the authority to increase our budget in fringe when we need it, But if we have any additional fringe, we can't move it anywhere. We can only decrease it. So we have the authority to increase it and decrease it as needed. And as time goes on and we have those fringe expenses, then the estimate for our budget will get better and better. At the end of the day, our estimate for fringe will be exactly what we spent in fringe.
Okay. I'm getting a lot of feedback on the microphone here, but can you hear me?
Yes, yes, sir.
Okay. I mean, $9 million is quite a bit more than what I define as fringe, one thing. And two, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should spend the money. And I still don't quite understand. You say you can move money from one year to the next, but last year, why wouldn't you have budgeted in the 2021 cycle this $191 million? I mean, this just doesn't fall from the sky in order to put together a project and a timeline for $84 million worth of construction. That requires, a lot of thought. So why weren't we thinking about this last year as the construction we were needing this year?
Sure. A couple other things I'll add. Again, with some of the nuances of state government, we're talking about authority and the authority to spend money or the authority to move money forward. And again, the original budget that we had in the GAA from even last year, from 2020, also didn't include a lot of the construction projects that we would have had the previous year as well. And so the way that state government works is that the General Appropriations Act is your starting point, and it's kind of like starting a football drive at the 20-yard line. And then as you progress forward, as you get more information, as additional authority comes because of donations that happen, because of new federal grants, then all of those things are factors in adjusting the budget. So that's why your budget is going to be higher at the end of the year than what it is at the beginning of the year. And then compounded, again, now we're talking about the second year of the biennium, so we always start lower, and then we have the ability to increase it for things like donations, for federal grants, all of those kind of things. Even in and of themselves within that year, they allow us to be able to increase our authority. But then on top of that, we have all of these other projects that the authority was sitting back in these previous years, and now the legislature allows us to move that authority forward.
Okay. I'm going to stop there because I don't quite fully understand your answer, and I don't want to take up the commission's time any longer. But I would ask that you come to Houston, we sit down, and you explain this process because it's a bit foreign to me. I have been involved in state government before, and I've not seen these significantly large increases in a budget year on year. So just if you will, come to Houston. We'll sit down for a couple of hours and go through it. Okay?
Commissioner, I do want to add just one thing, just to clarify on the construction. They've got a 5-year schedule to get all of our funding encumbered, and so it is rigorously planned out from the scoping, planning, engineering design, construction, post-construction inspection before we sign off on those projects. And on our construction budgets, which is, of course, the lion's share of the funding here that you see that's being UV'd from the first year to the second year, we always expect that roughly to 80 to 85% of our biennial budget appropriation is not going to be encumbered by us until the last two quarters of the second year. So this is not a surprise at all. The second thing I'll say on the federal funding, it vacillates greatly from year to year, just depending upon the amount of federal funding that we get through federal excise tax and grants. And so the Legislative Budget Board, when setting our budget, will give us an estimated amount of federal funds, but usually it misses the mark, not deliberately, but just because of the wide amount of variability because of the nature of the different federal funding streams we get. So, again, not a surprise here, but I do think it would be great if we were able to sit down with you and walk through it. Thanks.
I'm not really concerned about the federal budget. Understand the the lax nature of the feds in terms of how they would handle a project, but it's really the other issues that. So anyway, we'll do it offline just so I have a better understanding of how this 40%.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big number.
It is. It is a big number. No, look forward to going into more granularity with you on that. Thanks
okay.
for raising that.
Thanks. Oh, I had one. I could not see it. Sorry, I don't want to take up the mic fully, but visitations went from what to what? I couldn't read it here. Are the visitations way up this year, just COVID, and consequently revenue is going to be way up for park fees, et cetera?
Yeah, yes. To answer your question, paid visitation is up about 33.8%.
Got it. That's fantastic that the folks, you know, the citizens of Texas are using the resources. That's what we
want.
What we get paid to do, right?
Yep. Yeah. Well, and I think it's critical, commissioners, when we go into legislative session, we think about what constitutes a healthy, strong, vibrant Texas, and making sure that we continue to provide these services and that we invest in those services to make sure that they're meeting the needs and expectations of the constituents. And as you can see from really all facets of the outdoor recreation amenities that we help support and provide, they have really increased during this time of COVID. And, you know, candidly, our hope is that they will continue to increase once we get past this. But it's also critical that we sustain these investments in the parks and the WMAs and with our law enforcement biologist team to make sure, again, that we continue to support these. So really important trends, but important facts to be considered, we hope, by the legislature as they're thinking about the subsequent budgets for us, too.
You bet. Let's bring this up to them. I mean, visitation, more hunting and fishing. I mean, this is what we're charged to do, and so, but it takes money to do it.
Yes, sir.
But anyway, hopefully the trend on the boat and all of that. Hopefully, we're getting people out into the countryside. Which is what you just said. That's our charge. It's short and sweet. You know, we need life's better outdoors, right, Carter? Anyway, any other questions or comments about that item? Not hearing any. Thank you very much for the presentation. And we'll go on to work session item number 3, the internal audit update. Ms. Brandy Meeks, please make your presentation.
Good morning, Chairman, Vice Chairman, and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Brandy Meeks, and I'm the Internal Audit Director. This morning, I'd like to update you on the status of our fiscal year 20 and 21 internal audit plan, our recent peer review results and recommendations, and our recent and upcoming audits and assessments. And I'm going to, there we go. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Thank you. This and the next slide shows the status of our fiscal year 20 internal audit plan. All of our performance audits have been completed with the exception of the mobile devices cybersecurity audit, which is currently in the reporting phase. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. This slide shows the status of the 25 fiscal control state park audits on the fiscal year 20 audit plan. If we go back, please, a slide. Actually, go back 2 slides. And then, I'm sorry. One more slide, if you go back. One more slide. Thank you. And actually, If you go forward now, one slide, please. Okay, there we go. Perfect. This slide shows the status of our 25 fiscal control state park audits on the fiscal year 20 audit plan. As of today, 19 projects are complete. 3 are in the fieldwork phase and 3 are in the quality assurance phase. And we hope to have the entire fiscal year 20 audit plan complete by the end of this fiscal quarter. Next slide, please. So the next 3 slides show the status of our fiscal year 21 audit plan. This slide shows the status of our performance, IT, advisory, and follow-up projects. And as you can see, the Boulder Hunter Education System IT project is now in the fieldwork phase. We've completed the Q1 follow-up project, and the Q2 follow-up project is in process. Additionally, I am seeking the audit committee and chairman's approval to revise this year's audit plan for the loss of one auditor, resources needed to train a new auditor, and the possible purchase and implementation of audit software this fiscal year. This slide shows the proposed changes to our IT and advisory projects if we are able to purchase and implement audit software. So I am proposing the elimination, you can see on the right-hand side, I'm proposing the elimination of the employee offboarding process audit and the FLSA classification advisory project. Again, should we be able to purchase audit software this year? Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Thank you. As far as the fiscal year 21 fiscal control audits are concerned, the original plan included 18 fiscal control audits. And if we could go back one, please.
Brandy, this is Carter. I think we've got a lag between what you're seeing and what we're seeing. And so maybe if you just say what slide you want to see, and then she can keep it on there. What's the title of the slide that you'd like to have up right now?
Okay, yeah. If we could go to slide 5, internal audit plan fiscal year 2021, continue.
Okay. We can see that here now. And so when it comes up,
you can
start. Uh-huh. Yep.
Okay. I can go ahead and start. If y'all can see it, great. That's good. Okay, thank you, Carter. As far as fiscal year 21 fiscal control audits are concerned, the original plan included 18 fiscal control audits. That would include 14 state parks and 4 law enforcement offices. And as you can see, 2 state park fiscal control audits are currently in the quality assurance phase. Changes proposed to the plan to account for our auditor vacancy and the training of a new auditor include cutting the number of fiscal control audits by the number that was assigned to the auditor that we lost. I propose doing this as the auditor 2 position is an entry-level auditor position and considerable training time to train that auditor will be required to bring them up to speed. So I propose reducing our state park fiscal control audits from 14 to 10 and eliminating the 4 law enforcement office audits. So I've actually emailed the audit committee these proposed changes, and I've received approval from Commissioner Latimer. And I look forward to receiving Commissioner Bell's and the chairman's feedback. And according to TPWD's internal audit charter, those proposed changes will require the chairman's approval. Next slide, please. So
yeah,
we
Brandy,
also
we have that up. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Carter. We've also completed some special projects and administrative tasks this fiscal year. As shown in number 3 above, under administrative duties and as already discussed, we're working to fill an entry-level auditor vacancy. We've completed all interviews, and we hope to have this position filled this quarter. As also discussed previously and as shown in number 4 under administrative duties above, we are exploring the possibility of purchasing audit software. Currently, our audit shop still operates using a manual paper-based process, and the procurement of audit software, if approved, will help us work more efficiently by streamlining the audit process among all auditors and quality assurance reviewers. Audit software will also allow collaboration among all audit team members, even for those that are working in diverse remote locations. So it'll be a huge benefit to our shop. Next slide, please. So now I'd like to discuss the results of our peer review. The peer review was completed at the end of the first quarter, and we received the highest rating possible, which was a pass. This means that we are operating our audit shop in compliance with the GAO's Yellow Book standards and the International Professional Practices Framework Red Book standards, as well as in compliance with the Texas Government Code 2102, the Texas Internal Auditing Act. The peer review team also made three recommendations for improvement, which we agreed would enhance our audit shop strategic plan. Two, to work with the commission to define the commission's expectations regarding communication and the monitoring of the internal audit function, and to ensure audit strategic plan aligns with the agency's strategic plan. And lastly, to update the internal audit charter to clearly define my responsibility to perform analysis of audit resources needed to cover agency risks. As of today, we've not started work on these improvement opportunities, but I do plan to work with executive management and the audit committee to address all of these recommendations this fiscal year. Next slide, please.
Brandy, we have external audits, reviews in process, slide number 8 up in front of us. Mr. Chairman, it looks like we may have lost the connection with Brandy.
Like I said, I'll sure be glad when we get back to regular meetings.
So, Clayton, if you want to jump in here, but these are external audits. These are the kind of audits that, you know, we report on the commission pretty regularly, whether it's the Office of Inspector General and Fish and Wildlife Service or the comptroller auditing things. And so, you know, Brandy just mainly wanted to give you all a heads up of the schedule and the fact that these were going on. And so let you know, I don't think there's a lot to report here at this juncture, but we'll keep you apprised. Andrew, can you go to the next slide, please? Slide number 9.
And Carter, tell Brandy, thank you very much. We understand the technological problems.
Yeah, no, you bet. You bet. And then this next slide, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, has to do with external audits that are being conducted by the State Auditor's Office. They're not really an audit per se, like the position classification plan or the SAO releasing their report on the Schedule C salary schedule for law enforcement officers across the state that are paid in that particular band. But, again, just wanted to make you apprised of that. Andrew, let's go to the next slide. I'm not sure if I'll be able to answer any of your questions, but if not, I'll happily delegate those to Clayton.
And Clayton, you thought you were sitting there just keeping your mouth shut? You could.
I see everyone found that very amusing. Thank you, Carter.
Chairman, I think the only thing I'll add just on Brandy's behalf is, you know, I had a chance to participate with the peer reviewers that took a look from the outside looking in our internal audit program, and Commissioner Latimer heard some of this feedback as well. We had some very experienced auditors from other agencies that gave feedback, and overwhelmingly just were effusive in their feedback about Brandy and her leadership, her enthusiasm, her eagerness to learn. They were very pleased with the program as a whole. Obviously, they had some constructive suggestions on how to polish the proverbial gold, but all in all, I think the commission ought to feel really good about that look, and also how Brandy is performing in her role. So I wanted to just add that editorial comment for the commission to consider. I'm sorry we had some technical issues, and we'll work to fix those. But I think that wraps up that issue, Mr. Chairman.
This is Commissioner Latimer, and I concur with all of that in participating with the peer review group. I think especially since Brandy has been the internal audit director for, I guess, about a year, maybe a little over, and jumped in and COVID and trying to do audit work remotely, especially without software, had to present an overwhelming challenge that I can't imagine how she's done a magnificent job and in communicating with those of us who are the ex officio audit committee. And I just want to commend the whole audit division and the job they have done. And it looks like with her plan that it will only improve from here.
Carter and Mr. Latimer, thank you. Do y'all have any questions over the presentation?
I think you've done a good job, and I think all the reports that we get speak for themselves. So I think just keep doing what you're doing. Obviously, you must be doing something very right to have all these people happy with you.
Thank you.
That's not easy when you're doing audits.
Will do. I have a great team, so thank you.
Well, you do, and that's wonderful. Any other questions or anything from any commissioners? Well, that being the case, we'll move on to work session item number 4A, rule review, request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register, Chapter 57, Fisheries, 58, Oyster, Shrimp, and Finfish, and 63, Wildlife. James, please give your presentation.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm James Murphy, General Counsel for the Department, and today I'm here to present the rule review on Chapters 57, 58, and 65. Next slide, please. I will begin with just a brief summary of the rule review process. You've seen this in the last couple meetings that we've had, but just want to run through this briefly for the record. All state agency regulations must be reviewed no less frequently than once every 4 years. This review must include an assessment of the reasons for initially adopting a rule and whether those continue to exist. We do provide public notice of the proposed review in the Texas Register and solicit public comment, and then we must either adopt with changes, or repeal the rules based upon this review. Next slide, please. We do this on a chapter-by-chapter basis to keep it organized. We use a three-meeting process. The first meeting is a notification to the commission of the beginning of the process, and then we publish notice of that in the Texas Register. The second meeting is we seek permission to publish any proposed rule changes, and again, that goes into the Register for public comment. That is the meeting that we're here today on this group of rule chapters. And then the third meeting, we seek adoption of any proposed rule changes and appeals, and then adoption of the completed rule review, which means that we are retaining the remaining rules without changes. Next slide, please. Here's just to orient you on the calendar. You can see the chapters highlighted in yellow. We're at the permission to publish stage on these three chapters. Next slide, please. And we have no changes to recommend to you on Chapter 57 or Chapter 58. We will only be focusing on proposed changes to Chapter 65. Next slide, please. First of our two changes to Chapter 65 is in Subchapter H on our public lands proclamation. This is related to competitive hunting dog events. We have determined that we can make an amendment to the Social Security number requirements for these. Previously, we had required a Social Security number to all participants and spectators involved in the event. We have determined that we can request a Social Security number only from the permit applicant now. Social Security numbers, as you know, are a requirement associated with collection of child support, both under federal and state laws. And however, we do not think that that requirement means that every attendee at these events needs to provide a number. Next slide, please. This one is a very small one. We caught a unnecessary internal reference on means and methods that really was not appropriate to be included in that in this section. There's no change to the effect on law from this from this recommended edit. Next slide, please. And so our request is to permission to publish the proposed amendments to Title 31, Texas Administrative Code, Chapter 65, in the Texas Register for public comment. Available for any questions you may have.
I've got one. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Can you go back to the field trial? Keep going. Yeah. So what purview in regulatory authority do we have to have any involvement in a competitive hunting dog event, a field trial event? And why do we get involved in the business of trying to regulate it?
Commissioner, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure I have the background to answer that question effectively. I'm certainly open to any guidance from Clayton on that.
Right, Commissioner, for the record, Clayton Wolf. These are for events on our WMAs and possibly state parks. So this is only on state lands that we own and manage.
Okay, I understand. I was hoping that you weren't trying to create a regulatory process on private lands for competitive hunting dog events. Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you, Clayton. Any other questions for me or for Clayton?
Any other discussion by the commission? I'm actually with Commissioner Hildebrand on that. I don't think we need to bite off anything else. And then we got to regulate. But anyway, so any other questions by the commission? Okay, since there's no other discussion, authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. That gets us to work session item number 4B, rules review, recommended adoption of proposed changes and completed rules review, chapter 53, 59, and 69, finance, parks, and resource protections. James, you're still up.
All right. Thank you, Commissioners. For the record, I'm James Murphy, General Counsel for the Department, and I'm here to present the adoption of the rule review for Chapters 53, 59, and 69. Next slide, please. For the record, I will give a brief review of the item, the basics of our rule review process. This comes from Texas Government Code Section 2001.039. This is a review that occurs no less frequently than every 4 years. It includes an assessment of whether the reasons for initially adopting a rule continue to exist. We do put a notice of the proposed review in the Texas Register and solicit public comment. And then the rules must be adopted, the changes are repealed based upon the review. Next slide, please. As on the last item, we use a three-meeting process for this. The first is a notification to the commission of the beginning of the rule review process and publication in the Texas Register. That second meeting is the permission to publish any proposed rule or appeals resulting from the review, again, published in the Texas Register for public comment. And then this third meeting where we are here today on these three chapters is seeking adoption of any proposed rule changes and repeals and adoption of the completed rule review, which means retention of the remaining rules. Next slide, please. And to orient you on the calendar, chapters 53, 59, and 69 are highlighted, and we are in the third and final meeting associated with these three chapters. Next slide, please. We had no changes to the chapter 59 or to chapter 69. And we are only focused on changes to Chapter 53 today. Next slide, please. The first one is in Chapter 53, Subchapter A, for fees related to vessel, motor, and marine licensing fees in Section 53.16. This is a clarification that a replacement marine dealer, manufacturer, distributor card does not include a replacement decal with that. That is a separate request for a replacement decal. There's also a typo that was corrected in this. I do want to just correct a misstatement of mine during the November 9th work session. I incorrectly said that the amount of the replacement decal is $11. In fact, that replacement decal is $126. So misstatement of mine on that, I did want to correct for the record. Next slide, please. The second change that we have here is to subchapter B for stamps. This is in section 53.60. This is an amendment to eliminate the exemption from the upland bird stamp requirement for persons hunting under a non-resident spring turkey license. This is an exemption that we felt did not properly apply to non-residents. This is largely for residents and veterans and youth that these exemptions apply. And then we amended to remove references to a discontinued collector's edition stamp package that's no longer available for sale. Next slide, please. Our last subchapter is subchapter F related to bonded title for vessels and outboard motors. This is a change to section 53.100 for bonded title, just an incorrect internal reference that we have corrected there. Next slide, please. We received no public comments on any of these changes. Next slide, please. And before you on the presentation are the two motions that we will request for you to approve during tomorrow's commission meeting. I will read those to you in full, of course, during the meeting tomorrow. And I am available for any questions. Last slide, please, Andrew.
Okay, I'm back on. So if there's no further discussion, then we'll put this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. That gets us to work session item number 5, 2021-2022 Statewide Recreational and Commercial Fishing Proclamation, request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. We've got Mr. Krasowski and Mr. Gieslin. Y'all please make y'all's presentations.
Morning, Commissioners. I'm Ken Krasowski of the Inland Fisheries Division. Today, I'll be presenting our proposed changes to the freshwater fishing regulations. Next slide, please. As we discussed with you in November, our primary focus in this regulatory cycle is blue and channel catfish. We are proposing new statewide length and bag limits, and also will be proposing some changes to the exceptions to the statewide regulations. Additionally, we have to make some changes to the float dimensions for passive gears, which were recently changed. Next slide, please. Catfish are one of our most important game fish and are distributed statewide. The three primary species anglers fish for are blues, channels, and flatheads. Catfish are the second most preferred group of fish when we survey Texas anglers over the years. Catfish has been the focus of our attention recently. We have conducted numerous studies on how to improve sampling and data collection for catfish populations, and we surveyed anglers to see what they value about catfish. We worked on developing a statewide catfish management plan, which we released in 2015. Next slide, please. That led us to direct a team of our biologists to look at how we manage catfish, which they worked on over the last 2 years. An important part of this process was obtaining angler feedback on the potential changes we were considering. In addition to the statewide angler survey, last summer we conducted live webinars. We followed up with a news release and made the webinar available on our website. What anglers told us that they want to protect catfish populations but also want to harvest fish. These were our guideposts when we began our evaluation of our current regulations. Next slide, please. Our current statewide regulations for blue and channel catfish consist of a 12-inch minimum length limit and a 25-fish daily bag, which combines blues and channels. That's been in place since 1995. We have multiple exceptions in place, such as on the border waters with Louisiana and Oklahoma. We also have reduced bag limits, 5 fish per day, on community fishing lakes and similar smaller water bodies. In some of those lakes, we are stocking catfish. That supply of fish is limited, and we want to spread the opportunity to catch and or harvest fish to as many people as possible, and the reduced bag facilitates that. We also have exceptions for specific populations around the state to address population characteristics in those locations. Next slide, please. Our proposal is to remove the 12-inch minimum length limit on blues and channels. We would retain the 25-fish combined daily bag limit, but of those 25 fish, anglers could harvest no more than 10 fish 20 inches or longer. Impacts on anglers of the graduated bag restriction will be minimal. From our creel surveys, we know few anglers harvest 25 fish, and even fewer harvest more than 10 catfish over 20 inches. In our statewide catfish angler survey, catching big fish was not a major desire of most anglers, although some do focus on that. Most anglers said they would rather catch catfish to eat, and this regulation is designed for that, while also providing some protection for larger fish to improve quality and big fish potential. This regulation is appropriate for most waters statewide. Next slide, please. This exception is similar to the statewide regulation, no minimum length and 25 fish bag, but as noted in yellow, modifies the number of fish 20 inches or larger that can be harvested from 10 over 20 inches to two categories, 5 over 20 inches and then just 1 over 30 inches. This regulation directs harvest to smaller, easily replaceable fish and protects larger fish while allowing the harvest of one large fish. This regulation would primarily impact blue catfish anglers, especially those using trot lines and jug lines, but fat catfish populations of these anglers would benefit by the reduction in the harvest of larger fish. While it is designed to improve blue catfish population, it will also maintain quality in channel catfish populations. We have identified some anglers who desired improved quality in big fish opportunities, and this regulation addresses that. Next slide, please. We are proposing these 12 locations for this category. 6 of these locations, as noted in yellow, currently have exceptions to statewide limits. All these water bodies have catfish populations where we want to maintain or increase the high quality of those fisheries through the use of special limits. Next slide, please. The final exception we are proposing would be a 14-inch minimum length limit and a 15-fish combined daily bag. This regulation will be used in situations where there are concerns about limited spawning, sometimes combined with high harvest, which could damage the population, or for reservoirs that have experienced a catastrophic event such as fish kill and the population abundance needs to be rebuilt. Fortunately, we have not experienced any of those fish kill events recently. Next slide, please. 3 of these lakes we are proposing for this category, Bronic, Calaveras, and Fayette County, are power plant lakes that have high angling pressure, and we do sometimes encounter issues with catfish spawning in those types of lakes. Choke Canyon is a larger reservoir that has high harvest, especially for larger blue catfish. Proctor Lake is between Brownwood and Stephenville, while a popular spot for catfish has a low abundance population. Limiting harvest at all these locations could help boost population abundance. Next slide, please. We are also proposing to add 2 reservoirs to an existing regulation category. Texas Louisiana border waters currently have no minimum length limit, a 50-fish bag, and anglers are limiting to harvest no more than 5 catfish 30 inches or longer. These regulations are partially a compromise with Louisiana's more liberal harvest philosophy. These waters do produce a lot of catfish, so overharvest is not much of a concern. We are proposing to add two large East Texas reservoirs with similar catfish populations to this category. Livingston currently has a 50-fish bag with a 12-inch minimum, and Rayburn is under statewide rules. This will have the benefit of having our three big East Texas reservoirs under the same limits, as some anglers do fish all three. Next slide, please. We have three current categories of exceptions that we propose to eliminate. Those are a 30 to 45-inch slot and two categories with daily bags with limits on the harvest of fish over 20 and 30 inches. All these locations will be moved to the 5 over 20 and 1 over 30 category. Next slide, please. Blue and channel catfish are the only game fish that can be caught from Texas public waters and sold. This statute, approved by the Texas legislature in 1991, specifies the areas of state where this is legal. Next slide, please. This map depicts those counties and locations. In Houston County, which is the lone county within a block of yellow counties, only the Trinity and Neches rivers are open to commercial harvest in that county. In the string of counties inland from the coast, which includes Bastrop, Colorado, Fayette, Matagorda, and Wharton, only the Colorado is open for catfish harvest. On the border, only Falcon Reservoir in Starr and Zapata counties is open. Next slide, please. Also in statute is the specified 14-inch minimum length limit. We have a separate section in the proclamation for commercial regulations, so some exceptions that are proposed to be implemented in the areas legal for sale of catfish will also be listed in that section to be enforceable. Next slide, please. Finally, we need to standardize the descriptions for float dimensions in the passive gear rules. We propose to standardize those as length and width rather than height and diameter. Also, we inadvertently listed the width of the float for minnow traps as 6 inches, and it should be 3 inches. Next slide, please. In addition to the webinar and additional input we received from anglers last year when we were developing these proposals, we did present these proposed changes to the Freshwater Fisheries Advisory Committee, and they supported moving forward with them. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions or comments that you would have.
Okay. Any questions by any commissioners? Nothing else on that one. Then, Mr. Geisland, go ahead and give your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, fellow commissioners. For the record, my name is Dacus Geisland. I'm with the Coastal Fisheries Division. Today, I'll be presenting our statewide saltwater fishing proposed regulation changes for license year 2022. This year, we are requesting permission to publish two items in the Texas Register, one regarding crab trap fishing in certain waters in Aransas County, and a clarification item regarding red snapper bag limits in federal waters. Next slide, please. Our current regulations in specific areas of Aransas Bay include prohibitions of both commercial and recreational use of crab traps. This regulation appears to have been in place since the early 1960s. We're not exactly sure of its origins, but we do know the current regulation prohibits waterfront homeowners and shore-based recreational crabbers from fishing for crabs with crab traps from private or public piers from their homes, docks, and bulkheads. And just as a reminder, our statewide regulations for crabs include a crab trap limit of 6 traps per license for recreational use, and restriction that limits the checking of the traps during what we know is or refer to as legal shooting hours. The same period of day applies for moving traps and crabs from the traps. And you must use a valid gear tag attached to a buoy or a pier. Next slide, please. This map shows the restricted crab trap fishing area there in Aransas Bay. The area is highlighted here in orange. The area begins in the north at Hale Point and extends a half mile from the shoreline down around Goose Island, past the towns of Rockport and Fulton, and 9 Mile Point, and ending near Tally Island. Next slide, please. Our intent with the proposed change is to create more recreational opportunity for crabbing with traps from shores, docks, piers, or bulkheads. The recreational harvest from this additional opportunity is expected to be limited, and we don't anticipate this would impact the local crab population. This would not open the restricted area to commercial crabbing, and consequently, there will be no loss of opportunity for those commercial crab fishermen because the area is already closed. Next slide, please. As part of our stakeholder process, a public scoping meeting was held virtually in early December. Attendance was pretty low and primarily attended by those in Aransas County. All those attending the scoping meeting were supportive of the regulation change to allow the recreational crabbing from the fixed structure with a three-trap limit. This three-trap limit is consistent with other restricted areas along the coast, including the San Bernard River and an area north and west of Highway 146 in the Galveston Bay area where it crosses the Houston Ship Channel in Harris County. Our regional director based in Rockport has also received support from various community members, including many residents, mayors of both Rockport and Fulton, the Aransas County Judge, Aransas County Navigation District, and just last week we met with our Coastal Resource Advisory Committee, and they also supported this regulation change. The only concern we heard was regarding the length of line securing the traps to the fixed object. Next slide, please. Staff will recommend the following regulation changes relating to crab traps in Aransas Bay. We're recommending to allow recreational use of up to 3 crab traps in currently restricted areas of Aransas County. Crab traps would be required to be securely tethered to a fixed object. I've mentioned these 3, the dock, a pier, or a bulkhead. And this would not include any open water traps. Next slide, please. Our next item is a clarification item regarding red snapper bag limits. I want to be abundantly clear here in that we are not proposing any change to the bag limits, but simply clarifying federal water bag limits within our fishing regulations. Under federal rulemaking, states are authorized to establish season and bag limits for red snapper harvested from federal and state waters. Texas state waters, those waters from the shoreline to 9 nautical miles, are open year-round for recreational red snapper fishing with a 4-fish bag limit. By federal action, the federal waters 9 miles to 200 nautical miles, are closed until June 1 of each year, then reopen with a 2-fish bag limit. Next slide, please. The proposed change would clarify that red snapper caught in federal waters when open for recreational fishing count as part of the bag limit established for the take of red snapper in Texas state waters. This will hopefully prevent any confusion amongst anglers that may believe they can catch 2 red snapper from federal waters and then catch an additional 4 red snapper from state waters. This will also advance and streamline the state management of the private recreational red snapper in federal waters. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Commissioner Hildebrand, just curious, do we know what state of Louisiana does in federal versus state and bag limits? Just curious.
The federal limit is the 2-fish two fish with a 16-inch minimum size limit. And I'm unsure of their size limit in state waters, but it's also a two fish bag limit, I believe.
And I assume there's probably been confusion, two plus floor, you don't know where they're caught. You think this is a clarifying rule change?
That's the intent and spirit, Commissioner Hildebrand. We get calls every year asking, well, is the bag limit six or is it four? Mm. And we just want to be abundantly clear and include that within our fishing proclamation. As of right now, if you look in our fishing proclamation today, it just has the state water bag limit of those four fish. We want to include, since we do have that state management of those fish caught in by private recreational sector and federal waters, we want to include that in our fishing regulations just to provide a point of clarity.
Okay, fine. I would at some point like to know what.
This is Commissioner Scott. Where do we stand? I know we've been wrestling with the feds on all the red snapper limits. Do we have any information or is anything going to change that you can foresee in the coming season that will be coming up?
Commissioner Scott, that's an excellent question. We certainly hope so. And in light of the great red snapper count, which as many of you know, discovered that there was approximately three times the amount of red snapper in the Gulf than previously thought. As it is now, the National Marine Fisheries Service is reviewing that study and mulling over the results of that, and they'll be working with the Gulf Council, and really that's where this change would occur, through the Gulf Council. There'll probably be some discussion on that next week. We've got a week-long council meeting next week where I'm sure this will be a hot topic.
Well, needless to say, Commissioner Hildebrand and I, are, being from where we are down on the coast, we will, as will other commissioners, you know, everybody really wonders what's going on the red snapper limits and everything, commercial versus private, you know. And so, anyway, keep us posted, please, on that information.
Absolutely.
Any other discussion? If there is no more discussion, authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. That moves us on to work session item number 6, 2021-2022 Statewide Hunting and Migratory Game Proclamation. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. From the staff, we have John Gray, Sean Oldenberger, and Alan Kane. In that order, if y'all would give y'all's presentations, we'd appreciate it.
You bet. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, my name is Sean Gray, and I'm the Mule Deer and Pronghorn Program Leader. And today, I'd like to seek approval to publish the proposed pronghorn hunting regulations into the Texas Register for Public Comment. Next slide, Andrew. As I shared with you during the November meeting, the Commission adopted new pronghorn regulations in March 2013 to allow landowners to determine their own harvest strategy for bucks through an experimental system in the Northern Panhandle. This was a novel approach when it comes to pronghorn management. As in other areas, we use a limited quota system where permits are issued to landowners. Therefore, these regulations were proposed and adopted as a pilot project. In March of 2017, the Commission expanded and extended the experimental season for another 4 years because staff believed that more data were needed over a larger area to better examine the impacts of the experiment. TPWD has conducted this pilot project over the last 8 hunting seasons, and staff have monitored populations through annual aerial surveys and mandatory harvest check stations. Staff have also used hunter and landowner opinion surveys to evaluate support for continuing and expanding the experimental system. Next slide. Since these rules were adopted in 2013, I'd like to provide some background on the logic for proposing the experimental system for bucks. Staff reasoned that because herds in the northern panhandle are healthy and have stable reproduction, that a landowner-controlled system for bucks could work in these areas. Such a season could decrease workforce commitments and increase hunter opportunity by allowing landowners to determine their own harvest strategy. Another benefit of the experimental system is that it allowed landowners and hunters to book hunts earlier in the year. Permits at that time were issued no earlier than mid-August, following the annual summer pronghorn population surveys. Next slide. Staff believed after the experiment, if data suggested minimal or no decline in pronghorn numbers, sex ratios, average buck age structure, and hunter success, then no negative biological impacts would occur with the landowner-controlled system for bucks. Next slide. This map demonstrates current pronghorn herd units in the northern panhandle. The herd units in red are where the experimental season was initiated in 2013. The herd units in blue were added to the experiment in 2017. These experimental herd units were near Dalhart in the northwest panhandle and Pampa in the northeast panhandle. The experimental areas were representative of habitat, land ownership, pronghorn population, parameters, and permit demand and utilization throughout the northern panhandle. Next slide. In order to effectively monitor and assess hunter behavior and harvest impacts during the pilot project, as well as to facilitate compliance with proof of sex and tagging requirements, the rules required hunters to obtain a department-issued experimental permit. Because the annual person bag limit is one pronghorn, only one experimental permit was issued to each licensed hunter. Next slide. Staff used mandatory check stations located in Dalhart and Pampa to collect harvest data on the total harvest, age structure, and horn growth of harvested bucks. Hunters were required to present their pronghorn at a check station within 24 hours of harvest. Also, annual population surveys occurred in these herd units to acquire population trend, reproduction, and sex ratio data, which we compare to other similar herd units to help determine effects of the experimental season. Next slide. The population estimates for the Dalhart experimental area and surrounding herd units are shown in this graph. The gray line shows the population estimate for herd units surrounding the Dalhart experimental area, with the left y-axis depicting pronghorn numbers for this line. The yellow line represents years prior to the experiment, and the purple line signifies years during the experiment, with the right y-axis depicting pronghorn numbers for this line. Next slide. The trend line for the surrounding herd units in Dalhart experimental area, symbolized by the white lines, have a similar trend. However, in the experimental area, the population declined significantly from 2019 to 2020. Next slide. Formatted the same as the previous graphs, the population estimates for the Pampa area are shown in this slide. The gray line signifies the population estimate for the herd units surrounding the Pampa experimental area, with the left y-axis depicting pronghorn numbers for this line. And the yellow line designates years prior to the experiment, and the purple line represents years during the experiment, with the right y-axis showing pronghorn numbers in the Pampa experimental area. Next slide. The trends for the surrounding herd units in the Pampa experimental area, again symbolized by the white lines, have a slightly different trend, but are both declining. Similar to Dalhart, the population in the Pampa experimental area decreased more severely from 2019 to 2020 compared to the surrounding herd units. Next slide. Staff used population sex ratios as one guide to harvest intensity. During the experiment, only bucks were harvested, so higher buck harvest rates had the potential to reduce buck numbers within these areas. This higher buck harvest can cause sex ratios to become more skewed toward does. Sex ratios are estimated when staff conduct aerial surveys in June and July of each year. The 2011 and 2013 average sex ratio, represented by the darker bars, was estimated prior to initiating the experiment in the fall of 2013. The lighter bars represent the average sex ratio from 2014 to 2020, 7 years after the start of the experiment. In both experimental areas, the sex ratio has increased with a more drastic rise in the Pampa area. The pH category embodies all other herd units in the northern panhandle not included in the experiment. These areas have a more limited harvest because TPWD determines harvest quotas and issues buck permits for surplus pronghorn. Because of this system, sex ratios were more stable and natural in these areas during the same time frame as the experiment. Next slide. Age structure of harvested animals can be another measure of harvest intensity. This graph illustrates the average age of harvested animals in each area, in Dalhart and Pampa, as well as other areas in the panhandle symbolized by pH. The dark bars indicate the average age structure of bucks harvested within each area 1 year prior to the experiment, and the light bars show the average age of bucks harvested during 7 years of the pilot project. The age structure in both experimental areas is becoming younger with more severity in Dalhart than Pampa. In addition, the average age structure of harvested bucks in both areas is younger than other areas of the northern panhandle within the same time period. Next slide. To measure opinions about the experimental season, staff sent out questionnaires to hunters who participated in the experimental season and landowners in the northern panhandle in 2016 and 2020. Next slide. To gauge support for the experimental season, questionnaires were sent to these constituents. Hunters were identified as those who picked up experimental permits during the 2015 and 2019 hunting seasons, and landowners were anyone who had received pronghorn permits from TPWD in the past that had property in the northern panhandle. These questionnaires were sent to 267 hunters in 2016 and 229 hunters in 2020. In 2016, 672 landowners received the questionnaire, with 698 landowners being sent a questionnaire in 2020. Response rates ranged from 42 to 48% for hunters and 64 to 66% for landowners. Next slide. Hunter satisfaction in the experimental area was high when comparing hunter opinions for both years. However, hunters who were very satisfied or satisfied decreased from 77% in 2016 to 68% in 2020. Next slide. Over 80% of hunters responded in both years that they support continuing the experimental season concept in the current areas. Next slide. From 2016 to 2020, hunters that supported expanding the experimental season to new areas in the northern panhandle decreased from 83% to 71%, but most still liked the idea. Next slide. In the 2020 opinion survey, staff also asked hunters if given a choice, would they rather hunt for 9 days under the experimental season concept or go back to TPWD issuing permits to landowners with a 16-day season, which would extend the current season by 1 week. Not a majority, but 48% of hunters liked continuing the current 9-day season with the experimental concept. Next slide. In contrast to hunters, landowner satisfaction within the experimental areas has decreased from 47% in 2016 to 37% in 2020. In addition, more landowners were neutral in 2020 compared to 2016. Next slide. Landowner support within the experimental area decreased from 65% in 2016 to 57% in 2020 when asked if they would like to continue the experiment in the current areas. Next slide. When asked, do you support expanding the experimental concept to other areas of the Northern Panhandle? Landowners within the experimental area showed less support for this idea in 2020 compared to 2016. Next slide. As with hunters in the 2020 opinion survey, landowners were asked if given a choice, would they rather have a 9-day season with the experimental concept or return to TPWD issuing permits to landowners and extend the current 9-day season to 16 days. The majority of landowners within the experimental area wanted TPWD to issue permits and extend the season to 16 days. Next slide. Data indicate that the experimental concept seemed to have little to no impact on pronghorn population sustainability. However, the intensive buck harvest for 7 hunting seasons has had a negative impact on buck age structure and sex ratios within the experimental areas. With impacts to buck age structure and fewer bucks on the landscape, hunter satisfaction is decreasing, but hunters still like the concept. This is contrasted to landowners whose satisfaction and support for the experimental concept are declining. When given the option, the majority of landowners prefer a 16-day season with TPWD issuing permits and setting quotas over a 9-day season using the experimental concept. Next slide. Given the landowner support for a 16-day season, staff sent out another opinion survey in November to help determine how the extra week would fit into the current season. As staff have no substantial biological justifications on where this extension should occur, either by extending a week before or after the current season start or end. Next slide. To evaluate support for extending the season from 9 days to 16 days, staff sent out questionnaires to these constituents. Hunters were identified as those who purchased hunting licenses in 2020 and resided in the Panhandle and Trans-Pecos. Landowners were anyone who applied for pronghorn permits in 2020 statewide. These questionnaires were sent via two emails and one mailing. For hunters, a total of 4,665 surveys were sent out with only 438 hunters responding, a 9% response rate. The landowner response rate was much higher at 73% with 383 landowners responding out of 528. Next slide. Most hunters who have hunted pronghorn before and landowners preferred a 16-day season versus a 9-day season. Next slide. More hunters preferred starting the current season a week earlier, while more landowners favored extending the current season a week later. Next slide. Staff have intensively monitored populations and proposed to cancel the experimental season for bucks in the Northern Panhandle based upon excessive buck harvest causing younger buck age structure and more skewed sex ratios. In addition, the opinion surveys showed that landowner and hunter satisfaction has decreased within the experimental areas, as well as landowner support for continuing in the current areas or expanding the season to new areas. Also, when given a choice, the majority of landowners would rather use a 16-day season with TPWD setting quotas than the 9-day season with the experimental concept. Staff also proposed to extend the current season from 9 days to 16 days statewide, since staff issues pronghorn permits to set harvest quotas for each property, and that most hunters and landowners in the recent opinion survey liked a 16-day season better than a 9-day season. For the 1 week extension, staff recommend the season be changed to start the Saturday closest to October 1, which is the current season start, and continue for 16 consecutive days based upon the high response rate and opinions of landowners, since there are no concrete biological reasons on where this extension should occur. Next slide. And this concludes my portion of the statewide hunting regulation proposals. And before I turn it over to Sean Oldenberger, I'd like to address any questions the commission might have at this time.
Any commissioners have any questions or comments? Sean, I guess you're up.
All right. Good morning, Chairman and fellow commissioners. For the record, my name is Sean Oldenberger. I'm the Small Game Program Director in the Wildlife Division. Next, I'm waiting until here for the presentation to get up for Andra to get that loaded. Thank you, Andra. Today, we're going to be similar to Mr. Gray. We'll be requesting permission to publish changes to both the statewide hunting and migratory game bird proclamations for the next hunting season. Next slide, please. First, we'll start with upland game bird regulation proposed changes from staff with regards to the statewide hunting proclamation. Next slide, please. Here's the first proposed changes from staff. This would be to change the opening day for chachalacas to align with quail opening dates. That would basically be changing the opening date from the Saturday nearest November 1st to Saturday nearest October 28th. And just for your knowledge, too, this is just a three-county season, basically, in South Texas, where this population is on the northern extent of their range. The range goes all the way down to the middle of South America. Next slide, please. And so here, if you look at on this slide, you can see this is basically the current regulations as is for the 2022 and 23 and the 2023-24 hunting seasons. And so currently, chachalaca seasons would open during the first calendar on October 29th, which is the same as quail season, and run out until the end of quail season or chachalaca season. In the following year, that, due to the difference in regulations, would open November 4th, a week later than quail season, which would open October 28th. And so simply, we're just asking to align this because we're basically in this situation where every other year those flip except for leap years. And so it's just to align those to simplify regulations. Next slide, please. The next one has to propose change from staff has to do with eastern turkey regulations. This would be proposing to close the spring eastern turkey season in Panola County. As the chairman and commissioners are very aware, we've been doing an extensive eastern turkey restoration project for about the last 7 or 8 years in East Texas, in what is our Region 3 in the Wildlife Division. And so that ongoing stocking is occurring as we speak. We have determined some decision variables for closures of those counties. When we look at harvest is somewhat linear associated with population trends in these counties. And so basically, on average, in Panola County, we've had less than one bird reported harvest over the past three spring seasons, indicating very low abundance in that county. And also, since it does currently have an open season, it is not available for stocking either regards to our policies within the Wildlife Division. Currently, there is fewer than 50,000 contiguous acres occupied by wild turkeys. Next slide, please. So the slide in front of you presents basically the spring harvest in Panola County over the last 20 years. As you can see, starting in the early 2000s, we were averaging around a dozen or 13 turkeys taken per year in this county, indicating, you know, moderate population status. And as you can see here, it basically has been a precipitous decline over the last 20 years. And in 2016, we had our first year of no harvest in this county. Just a reminder for the chairman and commissioners, this is mandatory reporting in these counties as well. So these are not estimates per se, but hunter-reported harvest. We did have a bump in 2020, which is a couple birds, but the previous couple years of it had been no birds harvested in the entire county. Next slide, please. Moving on to further proposed changes from staff on turkey regulations, Mr. Smith talked about the mandatory reporting for the four doe days there in the south-central Texas counties. So we would be requesting to extend mandatory reporting in some of those overlapping counties with regards to this, what we call the one gobbler counties. There you can see on the map, those would be those, you can see the mandatory reporting in the East Texas season counties, obviously in East Texas there, and then more south central there, Texas, you can actually see those counties that we would be proposing to have mandatory reporting. Similarly to the DOE days, we've had good support from wildlife management associations and wildlife cooperatives in those respective counties for mandatory reporting. Most counties in question recently transitioned to the whitetail deer reporting requirements. And just to use as an example, we've done a number of research activities in those counties over the last 5 to 6 years, looking at that population. We really have really inaccurate harvest data when it comes to those counties right now. In our small game harvest survey, we send out about 20,000 mail surveys and email about 20,000 random surveys to hunters asking for harvest to estimate our harvest at a regional perspective. And I'll use Bastrop County as an example, which probably has some of our better turkey habitat with regards to those counties. Last year, there was no reported harvest in Bastrop County. The previous year, the estimate was 93, with confidence intervals from 1 to 475. So that gives us a lot of uncertainty with regards to how to move forward potential regulation changes in those counties. So this would be just to get some better information with regards to allowing the department to better manage the wild turkey population in these counties. Next slide, please. Moving on to another one. This is a little bit larger change, proposed change, and this is regards to the north-south turkey zone boundary. And basically, staff are proposing to make this consistent across the spring and fall seasons, where it currently isn't. This is basically to simplify regulations. And also biologically, this would push back the north, those counties that would transition to the north zone 2 weeks later. Based on research that has been done in those counties, this would actually align better to the recommendations from the Southeastern Wild Turkey Group out of CIFWA. Basically, that says they would like to see all those hens bred before a hunting season starts. And so a lot of those females, hens would be initiating nests at that time and that time of year instead of previously. So biologically, this makes more sense and also simplifies regulations. You know, somewhat with regards to his R3 things that Mr. Smith talked about earlier as well during the land and water update. So this was a commission request that occurred a few years ago and is following the fall boundary along Highway 90, similar to our deer regulations. Next slide, please. So here you can see a map of the current fall zones. You can see there in green, that would be the current north zone, and there in yellow would be the south zones. Those four counties was in light blue. Those do have special regulations that push that winter season all the way to the end of February. Next slide, please. And so here the proposed fall zones would just be transitioning those counties outlined there, basically moving those counties. Very similar, those are only four counties in the fall that we would be moving. Next slide, please. The larger transition would happen with the current spring zone. As I mentioned earlier, here you have the current in green, the north zone, and then yellow, the south zone counties. Next slide, please. The proposed regulation would transition those outlying counties, as you see, from the south zone to the north zone. So moving that, basically transitioning that season 2 weeks later than it currently is. And once again, shifting those 22 counties is just to simplify regulations and also biologically make that more feasible with the current wild turkey population we have in those counties. Next slide, please. Moving on to proposed changes in squirrel huntings. I know we don't talk about squirrels that much for the commission. We have had a couple requests in the last few years, most notably in the Panhandle counties, to actually allow open seasons where we do currently have closed seasons. Currently, we have closed squirrel hunting in 46 counties within the state. Obviously, most of that occurs in the Trans-Pecos and in the Panhandle. What you see in front of you is actually citizen science data from iNaturalist. The one there on the left is actually indicating where those folks have found gray squirrels in the state. Obviously, you see a lot of activity around major metropolitan areas where we have a large amount of our population working on citizen science activities. But then on your right side, you actually see their fox squirrels distribution on iNaturalist. And what you see here is over the last probably 50 to 60 years, as those populations have changed, if we increased irrigation, those urban areas and suburban areas have increased in population and growth. Our trees have grown. We've actually seen a movement of of basically fox squirrels moving farther west, and we've actually seen even gray squirrels moving across the landscape as well, with isolated populations in some of the urban areas and small towns surrounding those urban areas. So basically, the staff is proposing to eliminate the closed seasons in those 46 counties across the state. This obviously wouldn't increase harvest substantially. It is not a biologically concern, because that opportunity would exist in places where historically squirrel populations did not exist. Next slide, please. So here, as you can see, this pie chart in front of you, this basically puts at the squirrel harvest by ecoregion. And just so you're aware, we do have different regulations, not year-round regulations in those 46 counties as proposed, but in the Piney Woods, where a majority of our harvest occurs there, you can see in blue. But we do have some harvest opportunity that does exist in other locations. You can actually even see here with this pie chart, we do get some harvest in the rolling plains. It's not significant per se, but even 14,000 squirrels are taken in the rolling plains. And so just allowing this opportunity for a few folks to take advantage of it, it just makes sense with regards to those closed counties. There's not a biological concern or a resource concern in those closed county, and we're not trying to increase squirrel populations in those counties per se as a department. Next slide, please. Okay, we'll transition here to Migratory Game Bird Proclamation quickly before we turn it back over to the Statewide Hunting Proclamation to Mr. Kane after myself. Moving on to the next slide. And I wanted to make sure I gave an update to the chairman and fellow commissioners and everyone else that there have been some impacts with regards to our monitoring on migratory game birds with regards to COVID-19. Obviously, there's been impacts to all of us, but substantially, we do a lot of monitoring projects in conjunction with Fish and Wildlife Service and Canadian Wildlife Service across the range, breeding habitat ranges or migration ranges of a lot of these species. As you can see here, that map shows where all the breeding waterfall surveys are conducted across North America. Most notably there, if you look in the prairie pothole and in the parklands regions, they're in green. A lot of that extends, obviously, from the Dakotas, you know, all the way up to the Arctic Circle. Obviously, with COVID-19 occurring, the border was shut down between the United States and Canada. And also, you know, when we look at logistics and healthcare systems in those northern communities and those native communities in Canada, and even in Alaska, it's much different than sitting in Austin, Texas, right? And so they do not have the amenities that we have, and so obviously COVID infections could cause great concern there. So there was a lot of things that were canceled with regards to by Fish and Wildlife Service and the Canadian Wildlife Service when those had to be made and back in April of the previous year with regards to these surveys. Next slide, please. Also, there was other migratory game bird surveys that were canceled as well. The breeding woodcock survey that is conducted in the eastern one-third of the United States and Canada was also canceled. There was some states that did complete those surveys, but it was only a partial survey. Also there you can see in the middle on your left here, there's a picture of sandhill cranes roosting on the Platte River in Nebraska. That survey is completed in March of every year. Obviously, the timing was not good because the previous two weeks prior to this survey, most things were shut down across the states and federal government with regards to traveling activities. So that was the first survey that was being canceled. The good thing is the previous survey indicated well over a million cranes, sandhill cranes in the mid-continent population. And there were other small surveys that were canceled with regards to monitoring of migratory game birds. Next slide, please. Another thing, too, that I should note that does play into regulation setting is basically all banding was canceled across Canada, except for later in the season in some of the prairie areas by Canadian Wildlife Service. But obviously, we do a lot of and fund some research and banding activities that do occur in the Arctic and subarctic regions with regards to our goose populations, Ross's geese, snow geese, greater white-fronteds. And also, we have operational bandings with regards to Fish and Wildlife Service and Canadian Wildlife Service on duck populations. Just by getting those band returns, we can estimate harvest rates, we can estimate survival. Those do go into many of the models that allow us to set regulations on an annual basis. So unfortunately, there was a lot of things that took a hit last year with COVID-19. Next slide, please. And this next slide just really summarizes all the things that had to be canceled or postponed. Another thing is breeding bird survey, which is the largest survey of birds pretty much in the world that that basically monitors past ring populations and all bird populations across North America. And also here in Texas, we also had to cancel the spring Western Gulf Coast population of model duck survey. That's a breeding population survey that historically occurs in April on the Gulf Coast to monitor that population. And so, therefore, there was a lot of things that were canceled. And so, basically, we're going into with the Fish and Wildlife Service regulation setting season in this last summer where we didn't have any updated information in regards to population sizes. So the Fish and Wildlife Service had to do some modeling exercises to basically estimate what those populations may be 2 years out. And so we commend the Fish and Wildlife Service for getting those analyses completed and actually getting us federal frameworks so we could have the opportunity, as we are today, starting the process to set our migratory game bird seasons for the following hunting season. Next slide, please. And so really, to summarize that, since we didn't really have any up-to-date population information, as we all know in the business and most folks, with regards to populations, the best indicator of a population size is the previous year's population size, right? And so really simplistically, that modeling exercise showed the same. So the Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing no federal framework changes with regards to migratory game bird hunting seasons in the United States. Season lengths and daily bag limits are maintained from this previous hunting season. And the department staff is proposing calendar progression for season dates for all migratory game bird seasons, basically having the same hunting seasons as we have that are currently ongoing for the 21-22 hunting season. There is an exception to that, and I will point that out in the next slide, please. As I presented in November, we did, as a Central Flyway Council, a request to the Service Regulations Committee 2 extra days during the special white-winged dove days in the South Zone. You can see there with the map in front of you, the South Zone there occurring below basically Interstate 10 and Highway US 90. And so that special season is intended for only white-winged dove harvest. As we all know, if you do dove hunt, and anybody that's been paying attention in the last 20 years, we've had significant changes in white-winged dove populations across the state and even across the United States. So those populations have continued to grow even in Texas as we speak. And so we have continually requested to the service to expand that opportunity during that special season in the South Zone, since the South Zone regular season does not start on September 1st. So we were actually able to get approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to have 2 more days during the special white-winged dove days. And so we were going to go from 4 days to 6 days this next hunting season. Next slide, please. So here I can just show the harvest through time from when we started harvest surveys during this special season from 1997 to this last year. As you can see here, we started off with, you know, in some years in the late 90s only harvesting, you know, 50 to 70,000 white-winged doves during the special season. In the last year, in September of 2019, we actually for the first time ever harvested 500,000 white-winged doves during this special season. That's 4 days. We harvested 500,000 white-winged doves during that special season. Obviously, as this population has grown, it's become economically important to small towns and areas and outfitters and restaurants and gas stations and everywhere else in South Texas for those hunters getting out. So this has been a win-win for all Texans that enjoy this opportunity. We continue to grow this opportunity with these 2 extra days. This last year, we actually broke in 2020, similar to what Mr. Halverson showed with license sales. We actually had our largest number of hunters we've ever had during this season. Populations were down a little bit based on what we saw and anecdotal information. And so harvest was down, but as far as folks trying to get out and harvest white-winged doves during this special season, it was the most popular it's ever been. And obviously expanding it for 2 more days is just going to increase that popularity and assist across South Texas. Next slide, please. Looking at a calendar, this is really simple for this next year for staff proposals. It won't be that way in future years as this calendar gets a little bit more complicated. But you can see there in September, you see the regular season in gray as proposed by staff, and you see the what historically would have been the special white-winged dove days proposal by staff in yellow, with being September 4th, 5th, 11th, and 12th. And so basically we're proposing just to add the Fridays on there with a 3rd and 10th to this season, and that allows folks to plan ahead and possibly have a 3-day weekend of harvesting white-winged doves in their locale. So that just makes it really easy far as a staff proposal for this next year. Next slide, please. We are not going to go through all the calendars we historically do during this presentation, just with those proposed changes of only being calendar progressions. But I also wanted to point out to you in your commission booklets that there is an error that we did notice at the last second with regards to Sandhill Crane seasons in Zone A and Zone B. I believe in your booklets it says October 30th and January 31st for Zone A, and then November 27th to January 31st for Zone B. Those are incorrect dates. The correct dates are in front of you with this calendar. On Zone A, it should be October 30th to January 30th, and for Zone B, it should be November 26th to January 30th. So we apologize for that error, and we did catch it in the last second, but it was just 1 second too late. So apologize for that error once again from staff. But this would be the proposal if the commission decided to publish these in the state register. We would like to make that change. Next slide, please. And before I have questions, I'd just like to mention to the chair and fellow commissioners that all of these proposed changes were approved by both the Upland Game Bird Technical and Advisory Committees, as well as the Migratory Game Bird Technical and Advisory Committees. So that process continues to work really well with getting good feedback from both those groups, and it really helps us in this regulation setting process regards to coming to the commission. With that, I end my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions before we turn it over to Mr. Kane.
Sean had wrapped up his presentation, and he just wanted to let you know he was done and he was ready to entertain any questions by the commissioners.
I've got one. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So the additional 2 days of special white wing season, I see you put them on Fridays. I understand the logic around that, but wouldn't it be maybe more convenient for hunters to actually extend it and go the following weekend to Saturday, Sunday, so you would actually have 3 weekends of white wing season?
Yeah, so Andrew, if we can back up 3 slides to that calendar. Go forward one. There we go. And so, Commissioner Hildebrand, that's a good question. I should point out, and I failed to point this out earlier in my presentation, we can open the regular season on September 14th. So you can see here on the calendar on September 14th there in gray, that's when the regular season would open as proposed in the south zone. So we feel it'd be advantageous for all hunters to have the opportunity not only harvest special white-winged doves, but also mourning doves, more so than the 2-bag limit restriction during the special days. And so, therefore, when you look at it at a calendar, you know, that would push that back to the 17th. You'd push that back to the 18th and 19th if you're going to do 3 weekends, but then you'd have to push back the regular season. We know most of our hunting opportunity and our harvest occurs during the regular season in regards to our zones, and that would just allow more folks that don't have opportunities on especially on white-winged doves, but rather mourning doves, to get out earlier in the season as well.
I got it. Understand. My mistake. Good catch. Secondly, what is a chakahala?
Chachalaca. So chachalaca is I've tried one and been an unsuccessful. It's not like other upland game bird hunting by any means. It's more spot and stalk in my opinion, but it's a bird. It's a gallinaceous bird, very similar to our turkeys and stuff. It ranges from basically South Texas in those lower Rio Grande Valley counties all the way down to the central South America. And so it's a thorny scrub habitat. That's where it's native to. It does really well. It can hide really fast. They run and don't like to fly. And it is actually, it's we don't get a whole lot of hunters in South Texas chasing them, at least Texans. It's more of a novelty hunt for folks that have a life list per se, or folks that want something a little bit different to hunt. And obviously, if anybody's walked around any of that native thorny scrub habitat that we still have in South Texas, it is not the easiest place to get around. So it is more of a challenge than anything. But there's a lot of opportunity on our WMAs in South Texas to do that, but we do not have a whole lot of use with regards to that hunting opportunity.
Could we get actually a description of what it is? Maybe Carter, send it to me. I'd just be interested in the species. And,
yeah.
Because I've never heard of it before. And then lastly, just anecdotally, it seems as though duck and goose numbers are down this year in Texas, just from a hunting standpoint, certainly in Louisiana as well. But we don't have any hard data from a duck and or goose numbers, because all those federal, all the federal surveys were canceled. And do we do an actual survey ourselves of migratory birds? And did we not do it?
Yeah, great question. So, yeah, so the breeding waterfowl survey was canceled. I would like to tell you that, as you said, you know, populations are down across the South, a lot of weather-dependent issues. So, yes, we actually complete, as a department, the midwinter waterfowl survey, which is conducted during the first full week in January. And so I'm happy to report that our department did complete that. At any given time, we do have three airplanes in the air counting waterfowl from the panhandle to the brush country. And so we did complete that. We don't have our estimates quite done yet because those are it's a transect survey, so it has to be analyzed and get those estimates done. Anecdotal information, Texas would fall into what you said about Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas, what other states have said, populations were down. Heck, they had the largest midwinter waterfowl survey ever in North Dakota. I talked to my friend in Bismarck, North Dakota, when we had that little snow here in Austin. We actually had more snow in Austin, Texas, than they did at Bismarck, North Dakota that day. So that'll give you some ideas why those population numbers were down a little bit. But, yes, we did complete that, and as soon as we have that analyzed, we can shift that over to chairman and commissioners.
Great, thanks.
This is Commissioner Latimer. And Sean, did you or any of the constituent groups consider putting the 4 days over the Labor Day weekend, so extending Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday the 6th, and then just the 2 days the next weekend?
Yes. Commissioner Latimer, we did discuss that both in the technical and advisory committees. So just to remind everybody, this is an afternoon-only hunt opportunity that we have. So it starts at noon and goes to sunset. And so when we looked at that, we just thought putting it on a Friday and then having the next day being a Saturday would be a little bit more convenient for folks traveling compared to the 6th, where a lot of folks have to return to work on the 7th, that they probably don't want to hunt in the valley or somewhere else until dark and basically jump in the car and drive all the way back home. And so we just thought from logistics standpoints, putting it on Friday made more sense than Labor Day.
Thank you.
This, Commissioner Scott, and didn't we, a few years back, Carter, we changed the birds in possession to cover the extended number of days so that people that hunted 4 days, that's still in effect, isn't it?
I think it's 3 days worth in possession. Sean, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And so
yeah,
the possession limit's
3 days back.
Yeah, yep, yep.
Okay. I know we added a day just to try to keep people from being over the in possession limit deal to hunt the Labor Day weekend. But okay, thank you. Let's see. I guess you're up now, Alan.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name's Alan Kane. I'm the Whitetail Deer Program Leader. And continuing on with presentations from Mr. Gray, Mr. Oldenberger, I'll be requesting permission to publish proposed changes to the statewide hunting regulations in the Texas Register for public comment. Next slide, Andra. Thank you. The first change we're considering is, or proposing, is a minor housekeeping change to include crossbows in the definition of lawful archery equipment. The current definition of lawful archery equipment includes longbows, recurve bows, and compound bows. However, in the archery section under lawful means in Chapter 6511, The regulation refers to lawful archery equipment and crossbows rather than a single reference to all legal archery equipment. And this was simply an artifact left over from the time when crossbows were added as a lawful means of take, but never included with the definition of lawful archery equipment. Next slide. So in order to simplify regulations and provide clarity as it relates to all lawful archery equipment, staff are proposing to include crossbows in the definition of lawful archery equipment as seen on the slide. Next slide. The next change being proposed is a modification of the definition of muzzleloader. The current definition in Chapter 65 defines muzzleloader as any firearm loaded through the muzzle. This definition is ambiguous on what has to be loaded through the muzzle, whether that only be the bullet or projectile, or will require the powder, as well as other components of the muzzleloader ammunition to be loaded through the muzzle. This lack of clarity in the regulation leads to questions by hunters and others as to what is considered a legal muzzleloader in Texas, especially with changes and enhancement to muzzleloader technology. Next slide. Before discussing the proposed change to the definition, I wanted to take a couple of minutes to discuss the key distinction of a muzzleloader as compared to a centerfire rifle. The first muzzleloaders use black powder or synthetic substitute, whereas centerfire rifles use smokeless powder. And at minimum, the bullet or projectile is loaded through the muzzle rather than through the breech in a, as it is in a centerfire rifle. And unlike centerfire rifle ammunition, which is a single cartridge containing the primer, powder, and bullet, the components of muzzleloader ammunition are separate. It must be loaded separately, with at least some components being loaded through the barrel. As illustrated in the photos on the lower left, you can see the different components of the muzzleloader ammunition, which would include the bullet, the primer, and powder, which can be in a loose form or a pelleted form, or this the red plastic capsule is a pre-measured powder charge we'll talk about in just a second. Next slide. Additionally, muzzleloading firearms have changed significantly over time. As you can see on the slide, there's a flintlock and percussion in the top two photos there. And today we see the more modern inline or inline break action muzzleloaders at the bottom of the slide. The inline really came about in 1985, and that's pretty common for lots of folks today is those inlines or the inline break action muzzleloader. And so as we continue to see changes in technology, not only with the firearm, but with the ammunition and powder used in, with muzzleloaders. And the commonality between all these styles of muzzleloader firearms is that the bullet has to be loaded through the muzzle. At least the bullet or projectile has to be loaded through the muzzle. Next slide. Therefore, staff are proposing to amend the definition to clarify that the bullet or projectile can only be loaded through the muzzle. Amending this definition would remove any uncertainty for hunters and firearm manufacturers as to what is legal or not legal in Texas with regards to muzzleloaders. This proposal was prompted in part by a request from Federal Firearms Manufacturing Company earlier this summer about the legality of the use of one of their new muzzleloading systems called the Fire Stick that is used with the Traditions muzzleloader rifle. Next slide. The new Fire Stick technology uses a polymer-coated capsule to enclose a, the powder, which is essentially a pre-measured self-contained powder charge, as you see in the picture there on the right. Next slide. This technology allows for the loading of the powder charge into the breech, as illustrated in the photo, and then a primer is placed in the end of the capsule. Next slide. The bullet or projectile must still be loaded through the muzzle and is seated against the shelf in the barrel, as illustrated in the photo on the bottom. And then that, and something to keep in mind, the polymer powder charge, that fire stick, capsule, those dimensions and the shelf and the barrel of the muzzleloader to be used with this fire stick, prevent the use of center fire or shotgun cartridges or ammunition. So you can't use, 30-06 round in with this, in this muzzleloader. And additionally, the muzzleloader rifles that use this fire stick technology feature a recessed firing pin designed only to strike a fire stick and not any center fire or shotgun cartridges that could accidentally be inserted into the firearm. Now, although staff believe this new technology meets the standards of what we consider a muzzleloader, we believe the clarification is necessary to remove any uncertainty as to the legality of such technology. Keep in mind, if we do not clarify our current definition, it leaves room for interpretation by hunters and the public as to what might or might not be considered legal as far as the type of muzzleloader, potentially leading hunters to unknowingly break the rules if the department were to decide that this fire stick technology didn't meet the definition of muzzleloader or wasn't considered a muzzleloader. And the system, as we talked about earlier, still meets the definition of a muzzleloader because it's loaded through the muzzle. At least a projectile or is, even though the powder may not, but it still fits that definition. And so it's important to provide some clarification because even if a hunter didn't read all the rules and we didn't permit this to be a legal muzzleloader, they could still walk down to Cabela's. They're going to see Tradition's muzzleloading firearm advertised like that to be used with this technology, assume that the bullet's loaded through the barrel, and so they're assuming everything's in good shape. So the clarification is important. But aside from the clarification of the definition, the use of the fire stick technology allows for improved firearm safety by being able to remove the unfired powder charge easily. You just pop the breech open and pull that out and pull the primer out. It also prevents overcharging of muzzleloaders, putting too much powder in there, which could cause some issues because you have a pre-measured capsule with a certain amount of powder. And because of the ease of this system, it may also encourage hunters to utilize muzzleloader hunting, or other folks that don't normally hunt may be encouraged to hunt with a muzzleloader during that particular season, and it will be in line with the R3 activities to recruit new hunters or retain others currently out there. Next slide, please. Before moving on, I just also want to note that Texas is not alone in the review of this technology. That image on the slide depicts where the fire stick is already legal for dedicated muzzleloader seasons or in whatever season they allow muzzleloader rifles, which is those in green, and there's 14 states. And then those reviewing the regulations to create clarification around the fire stick, there's 20 of those that are in tan, and then 16 in white, it's unclear whether fire stick is legal. And I also had a recent conversation with John Zanell. He works for Federal Firearms Manufacturing, and he was just telling me the other day that Minnesota, Missouri, Florida, Alabama, Tennessee, Virginia, and Wisconsin are all in the process of working through the regulatory process to consider updates and regulations to allow for the use of the fire stick technology in Tradition's firearms muzzleloader that uses this technology. Those states are depicted in white, but they are under consideration right now. Next slide. The next change being proposed involves the trailing of wounded deer with dogs in 10 East Texas counties. So back in 1990, the commission adopted rules prohibiting the use of dogs to trail wounded deer in 34 East Texas counties. That change was necessary because dogs were being used unlawfully to hunt deer, which was causing the depletion of resources at that time. However, back then in the 80s and 90s, dog hunting was pervasive in the large part of East Texas. Next slide. By 2000, the department determined that the practice of using dogs to hunt deer had declined to the point of being non-existent in most of those counties, and removed the prohibition in 10 counties, those in that kind of reddish color in northeast Texas. In 2005, the department removed the prohibitions in Hunt and Washington County, the counties in blue. And in 2013 removed the prohibition in an additional 12 counties, those in purple on the slide. As deer hunting deer with dogs is no longer a widespread problem, or in the dog hunting culture, it pretty much died out compared to what it was 20-something years ago. And that left the remaining 10 counties in green with the current prohibition on trailing deer with dogs. Next slide. Over the last several years, staff continue to receive requests to allow the use of dogs to recover wounded deer in these counties. And after further review, staff no longer consider illegal dog hunting to be an issue or a resource concern. In the last 10 years, there's only been 3 incidences statewide with a total of 8 charges for hunting deer with dogs. And only one of those incidences occurred in San Augustine County in 2011 that resulted in one conviction. The other charges were in Duval County and Grayson County. Staff believe it appropriate to propose removing the prohibition on trailing wounded deer with dogs in these last 10 remaining counties. Therefore, staff are proposing to completely remove the prohibition in 6 counties in green, Angelina, Hardin, Nacogdoches, Orange, Shelby, and Tyler counties, and in the remaining 4 counties in yellow, which are Jasper, Newton, Sabine, and St. Augustine, allow trailing of wounded deer with no more than 2 dogs on a leash. Now, staff, you know, really discuss this, and although we believe that the prohibition in all 10 counties could be lifted, there has been a few comments from hunters and landowners in those 4 counties that I just mentioned to limit the trailing of wounded deer to no more than 2 dogs on a leash out of concern for potential resurgence in dog hunting. Now, to address this public concern, staff believe the best approach would be to make a gradual change in the remaining 4 counties by allowing the dogs to trail wounded deer but on a leash with the dog handlers in control, and then come back and revisit complete removal at a later date after folks are comfortable that dog hunting will not be an issue. Next slide. That concludes my portion of the statewide hunting regulations, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thing clicked off. Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Did you get any feedback from up there in East Texas about these proposed changes?
Oh, 3 of them, or the dog hunting specifically?
Yes. Dog hunting.
Dog hunting. Just the comments that some of our folks in law enforcement have received in those 4 counties, I think around Jasper there. We had a couple of landowners, one in particular, and I can't remember the name off the top of the head, that he was, again, wanting to have the opportunity to trail wounded deer with dogs, just, you know, helping game recovery. But like I mentioned in the presentation, he was there was some concern just on his part that, you know, dog hunting can be an issue. I don't know how real that is, if that's just a perception based on the folks he's talking to out there, but there hasn't been a lot of feedback or comment from folks regarding the dog hunting.
Chairman, I'll just add on to what Alan said. I did hear from Representative Ashby about this, and this is a topic that we've talked to him about over the years, and he is very supportive about what the team is proposing here and hopes that the commission will proceed with considering it in March.
Okay, good. Glad y'all followed up with him. Okay, thanks a lot, Alan.
Thank you.
Any other discussion by the commission? There being none, authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. That gets us on to work item number 7. Carter, I have maybe this is a question for you. Since we've got these next, uh, need items, do I need to go through them, or can I just refer all eight of them, 7 through 15, that we're going to hear those in executive session?
Sir, I don't want to prejudge the possibility that the commissioners may have any questions or comments before we refer them to executive session. If you would like to group these work session items and ask if there are any questions from the commission on any of those, and if not, I think we can group them and refer them all to executive session, if that makes sense.
It does. Makes perfect sense. So, fellow commissioners, if anybody has any questions or comments on work items number 7 through 15, please voice them right now. Otherwise, I would prefer to just put all of them together and we'll just discuss them at an executive session. Anybody have any comments or any questions about those items? There being none, then that's what we will do. We'll just discuss all of those in executive session. Does that work for you, Carter?
Yes, sir. Yeah, that's right, Chairman. Thank you. Okay. I think that's the most efficient.
Yeah. Okay. That being the case, at this time I would like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meeting Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of discussing those items 7 through 15 or deliberations of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Open Meeting Act and seeking legal advice under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act.
Chairman, yes, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to remind you, work session number 16, the litigation update, just you want to announce that that will be held in executive session as well as part of that. Sorry, on page 15 of your.
You're right. Yes. Thank you. I missed that one. Yeah. We'll do 16 too. So we're going to do 7 through 16 in executive session.
Thank you.
That'll work. So we will now recess for the executive session at 12:33. We will now reconvene the work session on January 20th, 2021 at 3:05 p.m. Before we begin, I will take a roll call. I know Chairman Moyen and Vice Chairman Applin aren't here. Commissioner Abel. Are you there, Commissioner Abel?
He may not have logged back on, Chairman.
Okay. I know Commissioner Bell isn't. Commissioner Gallo?
Here.
Commissioner Hildebrand?
Here.
Commissioner Latimer?
Here.
Commissioner Patton?
And Commissioner Patton is just listen-only mode, so.
That's right, listen-only, yeah. And then I'm present. We're now returning from the executive session where we discussed the work session real estate item number 7 through 15. Land conservation items 7 through 12 will be placed on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item number 13 will be withdrawn from the agenda for Thursday commission meeting. Items 14 and 15, I will authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process. Item 16, litigation update, we heard, and there's no further action. Mr. Smith, this commission has completed its work session business. I declare us adjourned at 3:07 p.m.